For 160 years, the men and women of the Associated Press have covered national and international news, and on any given day, they provide news for more than half the world's population. In a new book called Breaking News, How the Associated Press Has Covered War, Peace, and Everything Else, 13 reporters and editors chronicle how some of the most important stories were put together, not so much the stories themselves, but how the AP reporters got the scoop. I'm very pleased that it brings three AP contributors to this show, Vice President and Managing Editor Mike Silverman, reporter Richard Pyle, and photographer Richard Drew. Hello to you all.
Hello.
Hi.
And you each play different roles at AP. Mike, as managing editor, you're responsible for day-to-day news coverage. Who's covering for you now?
Well,
I'm sure something's happening somewhere around the world.
Yes, indeed. We have a couple of deputy managing editors who do quite well filling in when I'm away, and they're running down our latest out of the Sudan, out of Myanmar, Iraq, wherever else things are happening.
Now, you've worked as an editor since 1989. That's almost 20 years. Has the role changed as journalism moves to new platforms from print to broadcast to online?
Oh, it's changed tremendously. And I think that in the internet age that we're now, people more and more are getting their news first on websites and to some extent from broadcast, but even more online. The AP has been extremely well positioned because we're kind of the original 24/7 news organization. Our very founding was based on the idea that we got the news out as quickly as possible all the time.
But the internet tends toward very brief versions of stories, and it isn't my sense that the AP has been shortening the length of the things they supply to newspapers.
No, but we're aiming more and more to provide a material that's for the web first and then coming back with longer and more thoughtful analyses for newspapers. So we have to be a little more flexible.
Richard Pyle, you've been a reporter, bureau chief, and staff writer. Went from Detroit to Saigon in the 1960s. Immediately, or were there some intermediary steps?
No, I was in New York for some years, then I went to Washington, D.C., and from there I went to Vietnam.
And that was to cover the war?
Yes, it was. I was there for a total of 5 years, the first two as a field correspondent, and then by some stroke of madness that made me bureau chief for the last 3 years I was there.
Many people have remarked on how the wars, the Vietnam War and the Iraq War, have certain similarities, but the way they've been covered have been quite different.
Yeah, it is quite different. Vietnam was a unique war in many ways, and for journalists it was unique in the fact that we had almost complete unfettered access to the battlefield in a way we've never had before or since, and also there was no censorship. It would have been practically impossible.
And there are people who in government who feel that was a big mistake to allow journalists to have all that unfettered access, but isn't that part of what journalism is supposed to be all about?
Of course. I mean, The problem with the press had in Vietnam, or the problem that the officials had with the press, was not so much with the press in Vietnam. It was the problem with the analyses and the things that were being said and done in Washington. It wasn't what was going on in the field so much.
Not a lot of analysis goes on at the AP, does it?
Well, yes, we do a lot of analysis. I mean, analysis is part of the game. The AP has been described as the Marine Corps of journalism, where you hit the beach and then you move inland. But once you move inland, you've got to bring in the heavy artillery, and you got to do the other things.
And you were abroad for 30 years, and now you're back in New York?
I was abroad for the equivalent of almost 18 years. I've been back in New York since about 10 years now.
My guests are Richard Pyle, Mike Silverman, and Richard Drew. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. We're talking about a book called Breaking News, How the Associated Press Has Covered War, Peace, and Everything Else. It's published by Princeton Architectural Press. And Richard, as an AP photographer, you've captured images that help frame much of historical memory. We have a slideshow, in fact, of some AP photos on our website, which we will discuss later in the show.
Good, thank you.
Are AP photographers trained to have a specific style?
We are journalists. We have to have our style. We have to cover everything from sports to fashion week to the stock market to wars to politics, everything. We don't have many specialists. That's sort of we used to have people that would go out and they would work nights, like I worked 17 years of nights and weekends, and a lot of sports happened on that time, so I got to do lots of sports.
So is it all the same, photographing a sports event or photographing a battle in Beirut?
Well, I never photographed a battle in Beirut, but I like to think of you have to use your timing skills and your instincts every day on to capture the moment, and that's what we do at the AP. We have to capture the moment.
A lot of the pictures in the book don't have attributions. It doesn't say Richard Drew, for example. It just says AP photo.
Well,
is that part of the job?
We used to say that was long before. There were time in the AP when it just showed up as AP photographer, and we like to have a joke that it stood for anonymous photographer, AP. But as the years went on, we got photo credits, and I actually have there's a photograph in the book of mine. It's the Falling Man picture from the World Trade Center.
Mm. Now that is one of those pictures that disturbs a lot of people. Photographers have to take them, right? There are those famous shots from Vietnam, for example, of the Vietnamese officer shooting a man in the head.
Mm-hmm.
And there's that famous photograph of the young woman running down the road almost nude because she has been hit by napalm. You're the only people who are witnesses to that sort of thing?
We record history every day, and whether it be, like I say, you're talking about how it caused a controversy, my Falling Man picture. You didn't hear the controversy a lot about the little girl running down the road, or that shouldn't be shown, or even John Filo's picture of the student who was shot at Kent State. And I think the problem with my photograph is that we could identify too much with it here, and that it was actually, you don't see any this person dying. If this is a part of this person's life, and I think that people see into it that it could be them.
Mike, how did the Associated Press begin? 1846, right?
Yes,
here
and
in New York
that's
City?
A date that we only recently discovered. For a long time, we thought our founding dated from 1848, when a group of New York publishers got together to get the news from the boats coming in from Europe faster. But it turns out that there was a version of the AP that started during the Mexican War. The telegraph lines extended only as far south as, I think, Montgomery, Alabama. And to get the latest news from Mexico faster, there was a deal worked out to go in on a Pony Express operation to race it up as far north in Alabama to the telegraph lines. And that was a cooperative venture by some publishers that we now say was the beginning of the AP.
Well, that cooperative venture was really important in setting a certain tone for American journalism in general, isn't it? Because the AP had to serve newspapers with very different political positions. It had to be as objective as possible. Was that the beginning of that standard, the goal of objectivity in news reporting?
I think it was, and we've clung proudly to that tradition of being accurate. We say we want to be first, but first we want to get it right. We don't have any editorial point of view that intrudes into our copy. Even in our analysis and explanatory journalism, we work very hard to keep the reporter's personal viewpoint out of it, at the same time to have the reporter's expertise get into the story.
And then there's always the problem of it is an American service, and so there is an American perspective on the news,
well,
isn't there?
Well, that has been true, but I think in recent years we've worked very hard to stake our claim as an international news organization. Our reporting from around the world is not all done by Americans, and not even for the most part by Americans, and we have a very high expectations that we provide a report that's balanced and not just how the Americans would see something.
How did that work for you, Richard Pyle?
Well, everywhere I've been.
I mean, you had opinions, didn't you?
Well, of course we had opinions, but you'll never see it in the AP copy. Every place I've been, which includes the Middle East and Asia, you always were dependent on local people. One of the most amazing things about the AP, I think it applies to other news organizations as well, is the loyalty, the dedication of the local employees that are hired there. They go to the wall for you, and it's an amazing thing to see. Everywhere I've been, that's been the case. Everywhere I've been, there have been non-Americans working for AP, that is, Europeans and so forth, and they do what we do. And it's truly an international operation. I think that how many countries is it? 150 countries and 4,500 people, whatever it is, of which about 3,000 are actual journalists around the world. So we are based in New York, and we're an American company, but we are not a strictly American company. It's a very international operation, and if you work overseas, you become an internationalist whether you really want to or not.
Richard Drew, is
yes,
it
sir.
Possible to not be objective in taking a photograph?
You have to be objective, and that's, like Mike and Richard said, that is our main goal. We can't take a side. We have to show what's happening at that moment. Richard said that we're like the Marines. We hit the beach. I like to say we're first responders. Whenever something happens, emergency, you have to show up and do your thing.
I'm sure you have witnessed things like the falling man that were very powerful. Are you able to maintain a certain dispassionate stance?
I like to credit my wife saying that the camera for me is like a filter. I go out there and I put the camera up to my eye and I take my pictures and I do my job, and only later on do I get my post-traumatic stress syndrome comes through, and when it all finally sinks in. Before I joined the AP, I was one of three photographers. Four photographers that was in the kitchen when Robert Kennedy was shot in Los Angeles. I was working for a newspaper in LA at the time, and at that time I had to also do my job and my thing at that time.
Take the pictures.
Absolutely.
It must have been hard because you're so emotionally involved in both cases, just the horror of the
thing. Well, you have to remain cool and dispassionate in the whole thing, and you just have to photograph what's happening in front of you.
I wonder about this book, The Breaking News. This is the first archive published since 1940, isn't it?
Yes.
What's taken so long, Mike?
Well, a number of things happened. We had wanted for some years to come out with a comprehensive new look at the AP and its history. And then in the course of moving from our longtime headquarters at Rockefeller Center, we dug up some somewhat neglected archival material, which had been literally stored underground and nobody, I don't think, had looked at in a systematic way. We hired an archivist, and she's marvelously gone through everything and discovered a lot of original documents and things about our past that we didn't know. And we turned a number of reporters, including Richard Pyle, loose on it, and they came up with these fascinating chapters.
And were you at all surprised by some of the things that you found?
Constantly surprised. Writing this book has been a great experience, and it's been a voyage of discovery, and especially for somebody like me. I've been around the AP for more than 40 years. And the chance to reach back into history and to trace all this and to discover who these people were, many of whose names were not known. Some of the names are known, but you didn't know much about them. And the research on this book has been a very interesting and exciting experience to uncover all this and find out who these people were and to discover things like the fact that everything that we do today, they did back then. The technology changes constantly. It's gone through tremendous revolutions over and over, but the basic bedrock, hardcore principles of what we do has been the same from the beginning and still the same.
You're talking about as journalists.
Yes.
But you wrote the two chapters about war.
Yes.
And you've covered a war yourself, so there must have been some kind of a personal relevance.
Oh, I've covered six wars, actually. Oh. But the Vietnam is the anybody who was there, that's their thing. There was a lot of resonance to what I found out and what I wrote. And I had the experience of when I was in the AP in Washington years ago, there were some of these guys from World War II who were still there. They were nearing retirement, and I had the opportunity to know some of them. My regret now is that I didn't pay more attention to them and sit down and talk to them.
In the early days, of course, stories took a lot longer to get from one place to another. The Mexican War was 1846. The Civil War, we did have the telegraph, but
yes.
It still was a lot harder to get a story out and get a story out completely. Is that reflected in the way the stories were written?
I think it is. In the beginning, when you think about this 1846, the telegraph and the AP came into existence simultaneously. And that was a symbiotic relationship that was very fortuitous. It meant that news and information that previously moved at the speed of the fastest horse was suddenly moving with the speed of light. And two people in different places who never had any connection to each other or knew anything about each other could receive and react to the same information at the same time for the first time in history. And when you put that in the context of the AP being the purveyor of this news information, that's quite a thing.
And it was always important to be the first when something important happened. But AP also said it was important to be the last. Others would cover the story and then leave, and there were still things that had to be dealt with, Mike?
Well, yes, and Vietnam being a wonderful example, yeah. George Esper, one of Richard's colleagues, was the just about the last guy out to turn off the lights after the North Vietnamese took over Saigon. And we have a tradition of AP people refusing or being very reluctant to leave the scene of a major story. As you say, we want to make sure that we don't miss anything at the end as it's being mopped up.
My guests are Mike Silverman, Vice President and Managing Editor at Associated Press, reporter Richard Pyle, photographer Richard Drew. We will continue our conversation about this book, Breaking News, How the Associated Press Has Covered War, Peace, and Everything Else, from Princeton Architectural Press. Lots of pictures in this book right after this. We're back with three people from the Associated Press talking about a book called Breaking News, How the Associated Press Has Covered War, Peace, and Everything Else, from Princeton Architectural Press. Photographer Richard Drew, reporter Richard Pyle, and Vice President and Managing Editor Mike Silverman. Everything has become a lot faster. We were talking about the Internet. But in the early days, photographs took a lot longer to take. Matthew Brady in the Civil War, he was hoping that people wouldn't move for 10 seconds or more.
However long it took. And I was just saying that my job has changed so much just in my 37 years with the AP. I started out shooting black and white 35 millimeter photography and working in a bathroom if I had to work on a portable assignment somewhere around the world. And now I carry a digital camera or two and a laptop, and I can send pictures via the Internet or via an air card, you know, over the cell phone system while I'm driving my car down the street.
Now, was Associated Press, did it have a monopoly initially, or was Reuters already out there?
Well, I think Reuters was in existence, but mostly in Europe and Asia and Africa. They're a British company, and their strengths pretty much reflected the direction of the British Empire during the 19th century.
They were using carrier pigeons. They weren't using the telegraph. Didn't get into Europe until late the 19th or early 20th century. So everybody over there was way behind schedule on the technology.
But was there a real sense of competition? Then later, UP, United Press, came along at the end of World War I. That, again, must have affected things. Was it just a matter of who was going to get there first, or did you all influence each other?
Well, I think there was this sense of an epic battle that was ongoing. When I joined the AP in 1971, UPI was quite strong still, and there were famous stories, some of which are in this book, about not just the victories, but some of the defeats. AP was not first in the word of John Kennedy's assassination. UPI Washington reporter famously wouldn't give up his phone in the car to his AP colleague and claimed it wasn't working right, and that cost us dearly. But the battle to be first, I think, has been was an exciting one. and it probably energized both organizations.
Well, what was the need for two unless there was a feeling that AP wasn't doing something right?
Well, initially, UPI was not a cooperative the way the AP is owned by the newspapers. It was owned by Scripps Howard by the time I came around, and it was a money-losing proposition that they kept in business for years and then eventually had to give it up. As you say, there really wasn't a business model for two similar organizations. And a lot of people said when UPI pretty much went out of business, well, AP reporters will never run for the phone again. And I think we've proved the folly of that. There's a million competitors to be first with a story. They may be called something different. But
now there's a lot of amateurs out there who are competing with you.
Citizen journalism, they're calling
it. A lot
that,
of
right?
citizen journalists, which we welcome and use their material when we can confirm it. But there's a lot of misinformation and pseudo-information on the web as well.
Well, that has to be a problem for photographers as well, because anyone with a digital camera can take a picture and send it off to a newspaper instantaneously.
Or they can take Photoshop and they can alter it to make it what they want to look like, too.
As we saw not that long ago, where some photographs came in from Lebanon where smoke had been added to photographs. But that was caught. Are they usually caught? Are the fakes usually caught?
I think probably most of them are, because other photographers see it. They can spot it. Editors are alert to this kind of thing. It's not to say that it doesn't happen, but I think sooner or later it gets found out. If a picture is – there are certain criteria that everybody understands about post pictures and that kind of thing. Photographers all know this, and people can look at it and say, that's a fake. And people just don't do it because they're going to get found out.
There have been real concerns expressed over the course of the 20th century about new strategies that were imposed to manage the press, media pools, and more recently, embedding reporters. How do you maintain your integrity when somebody else is trying to force you to write articles in a way or take pictures of things that you think should be done differently?
We have our own personal integrity at the AP that as journalists, as any journalist should, that you would that you take your picture, you write your story in the way you see it and without influence.
But I think it is a real problem, and it's not so much that people are trying to tell us how to write the story as it is denying access, and that's something that our CEO, Tom Curley, has been very, very vigilant in fighting for. There's been a huge attempt under the Bush administration and in recent years to reduce the amount of information that journalists have access to. The embedding.
Well, isn't there always a war between the politicians, the people in control?
To some extent, because it's journalists' job to expose wrongdoing, among other things, and it's in the politicians' interests often to cover it up. But the embedding of journalists with troops in Iraq has been kind of a double-edged sword. We welcomed it to a great extent because it did allow us to have access, but on the other hand, it gives the military control over what you can see and what you can report. So we always tried in the early days to have independent journalists who weren't embedded. That became more and more difficult as it got more dangerous.
And what about the danger? Is there some training for journalists about how to avoid as much danger as possible when they're in a war zone?
Let me speak to one thing first before I get to that. There is in our business and certainly in the AP, if you've done this for a while, for years, in difficult places especially, there's a discipline that is developed, built into you after a while. You understand the firewall between your opinions and the news, and you also have a discipline about no matter what somebody is trying to get you to do or to persuade you to do something or not, you're alert to that, and you just don't do that. And it's become second nature. As far as the business of the danger, in recent years, all news organizations have sent their potential war correspondents to training camps for survival training, what to do if you're caught in a terrorist situation.
Minefields,
all kinds of things. And this training has probably saved some lives. I mean, you don't know how many have been saved because the people you know, are still walking around, but it probably does work.
And then there is the other side. A number of reporters have died in Iraq, haven't they?
We've lost six, all Iraqi journalists, the kind of people that Richard was talking about earlier, who are incredibly dedicated to telling the story of what's going on in their country. And they face terrible dangers, both from the insurgents and sometimes from the U.S. military, which is suspicious of them, too.
My guests are editor Mike Silverman, reporter Richard Pyle, and photographer Richard Drew, all of the Associated Press. We're talking about the Associated Press because of a new book called Breaking News, How the Associated Press Has Covered War, Peace, and Everything Else, published by Princeton Architectural Press. We were talking about pressures from the government or whoever else is being covered to get the right kind of story out there. But what about the other side? The Associated Press or any other news organization puts together a report, takes photographs, sends them off to a newspaper or magazine, discovers that it's been changed a bit. Maybe the photograph has been cropped. Can you protect yourself?
Well, cropping of photographs is a time-honored practice that we
can't do much about. But you can crop a photograph and make it look like something very different than the... No, you can't? You're saying,
no.
Richard,
We put the picture out there as it is. We crop it for the impact or crop it to its central focus. We don't crop out something because it will change the what the picture looks like.
But I think a news organization that's going to publish it sometimes could, and you know, if there's something that we think is a violation, our stories are not immune from any editing by a newspaper that's going to publish them. That's quite acceptable. But if bias is introduced, for instance, there was an incident with a news organization I won't name that was changing our use of the word suicide bombing to homicide bombing. And we objected to that because the AP was not using that phrase, and we didn't want that appearing under our name.
Because it does say Associated
yes,
Press on the
all,
byline.
Yes, after all, it does say it.
As far as the photography end of it, I can refer to my Falling Man picture and sort of censorship that went on. A lot of newspapers around the world wouldn't publish it. It wasn't the New York Times. Several papers who ran it got a lot of flack for running it, and it hasn't been republished. It just people don't want to use that picture.
You actually covered both World Trade Center bombings.
I did. I was there in 1993. I was one of the photographers that they allowed to go down in underneath in the garage, like the first morning afterwards. And sort of a pool situation. They let me go down and do that.
Part of the thing that makes what you do extraordinary is that, and I'm talking about everybody in this business, is being there. When I think of some of these iconic pictures, the picture of the Hindenburg exploding, Nick Utt's famous photograph of 9-year-old Kim Fook as she ran naked down the highway after she had been burned by napalm. The photographer had to be there.
I was thinking about photographs that you asked before about things that really get to me and I was in the Dominican Republic several years ago covering a Caribbean baseball series, and I got a call at 2 or 3 in the morning from one of our foreign editors that said a plane full of German tourists had crashed into the Caribbean. And I had to go to the other side of the island, and they were bringing in the bodies and all. And they didn't have – and there was a local flotilla of fishermen and boats that went out to bring back the bodies that were floating. And they were stacking them like cordwood on the deck of the boats. And as they were figuring out who they were, one of the people picked up a small child by one of his legs and sort of held him upside down while he's putting him in this bag. And that really – because I'm a father of four children, and that really got to me. And I had – this the only time I can think and I really had to stop for a minute, compose myself, and then go back to doing my job. Mm. But you're right. Somebody had to be there to take that picture.
I like to point out that with all due respect to my many friends in the photo side, that reporters have to be there as well. And we're not sitting back in the office waiting for these guys to come in and tell us what happened. We're also out there.
Although sometimes the photographers are the reporters, aren't they?
Well, they would go both ways. Vietnam is the best example where everybody who carried a camera, we all carried cameras. We all took pictures, and all the photographers took notes, and we wrote stories under their bylines. And we had credit on photos that we took and were sent on as wire photos. So it was a mutual arrangement, and everybody was doing the same thing.
A number of callers have asked what happens when a reporter is witnessing something horrible and has a choice between taking the picture, writing the story, and intervening. can you just intervene?
Yes. I think that every reporter, photographer may at some point in his or her career face this dilemma, and they're always different. Every situation is unique, and therefore there's no rule for this, but you're a human being first, and if you have to drop your camera and save somebody, then you do that. Nick Ut, you cited Nick Ut's example. Nick got the picture of Kim Fook running down the road, but then he put down his cameras and he took her to the hospital. And they became fast friends as a result of that. So this kind of thing does happen, and people are faced with this choice, and if it's a choice, you have to make it whether you're going to be professional first or you're going to be a humanitarian first.
Throw a blanket over somebody who's burning to quell the flames.
That's doing that is better than taking the picture of it.
Mm. But if you can do both, you would do that too. In the case of your falling man picture, Richard,
yes.
There was no way you could do anything other than be horrified.
He was one of several people that I photographed. I can only remember what the count was. I don't think I've ever counted how many people I photographed that were falling from the World Trade Center. I don't know whether he jumped. I don't know whether he was pushed or the flames blew him out or what.
With real problems in the newspaper business and in, I guess, television news as well and budgets being cut back, does that actually make the Associated Press more important? Or have you been cutting back as well? Do you have bureaus in all the places you would have had them 30 years ago?
Well, and more. We've opened new bureaus. We have a television bureau based in North Korea now, which we're delighted about. We're working very hard to open an office in Saudi Arabia, and we'd love to get an office in Iran. Yes, many newspapers have closed down their foreign operations, Baltimore Sun, the Boston Globe among them, and they do rely more on us. We're very committed to a vibrant international news report and don't anticipate anything but further expansion.
Well, since a country like North Korea really doesn't like to have newspaper people present, is it because the Associated Press is what it is that you get a certain access that others might not?
Yes, and then initially there's a wariness even of us, but we're hoping that over time and being there, as has happened with our bureau in Havana, Cuba, where it was a big deal for them to let us in initially, and now we're treated like a regular member of the press.
I want to thank you all so much for being with us, Mike Silverman, Richard Pyle, Richard Drew. The book, Breaking News, How the Associated Press Has Covered War, Peace, and Everything Else, is published by Princeton Architectural Press. It's been a real pleasure talking with you.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Thanks. On tomorrow's show, we will look at the legacy of the civil rights struggle for equal education today, 50 years after the desegregation ruling in Little Rock, Arkansas. And then children's book illustrator Eric Carle, loved by children of all ages, for The Very Hungry Caterpillar. Plus, Jane Alexander talks about her new movie, Feast of Love, and her HBO series, Tell Me You Love Me. Also, an incident unreported in the West, the violent takeover of Islam's holiest shrine by Muslim fundamentalists in 1979. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Sarah English and Blake Neshek. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Bridget Bergen, Angela Sheldon, Rachel Krantz, Barbara Kahn, Stephanie Hughes, and Scott Goldberg. Debbie Daughtry was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. We'll see you tomorrow.